This week on the Best of Flashpoints, internationally renowned Middle East reporter Robert Fisk talks about Afghanistan, Iraq, and the recent attacks in Gaza, how the Western press fails miserably to cover these stories, and why. An interview with People's History of the United States author Howard Zinn. And Catherine Austin Fitz on Obama and the stimulus and bailout packages in this week's edition of Community Business. Dennis Bernstein's coming up with all this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We're delighted to be joined again by Robert Fisk, award-winning reporter for The Independent of London, based in Beirut, Lebanon, author of a number of books, including the very substantial The Great War for Civilization, The Conquest of the Middle East. And this man knows more about what's been going on in the region than probably anybody alive today. Robert Fisk, welcome back to Flashpoints. We have here a new president, Obama. We haven't spoken to you since. Let's start by taking a look at what he seems to be doing in Afghanistan, which is expanding a war and doing more bombing in Pakistan. Your response?
Well, I was actually in the States during the election, and I was broadcasting on Al Jazeera International quite a lot and Al Jazeera Arabic. And I said repeatedly, especially to the vast numbers of Arabs who thought that Obama was going to save the Arab world, nothing will change. I go to Washington a lot, I go to Congress, I go to the Senate, and the fact of the matter is that Washington, the motive power of Washington as an institution and U.S. governments as an administration is not democracy or human rights or freedom, it's about power. And unless you can find a way to re-examine, re-explore, and change the nature of the relationship between the U.S. administration and Israel, there's going to be no change whoever becomes president of the United States, and I said that repeatedly. We've had several interesting points from Obama before the election, when he made his obligatory trip to what was laughingly called the Holy Land. He spent 45 minutes with the Palestinians and 24 hours with the Israelis, and I think that pretty much told you how it is. Now, Obama's obviously a smart guy. I read one of his books. He wrote it himself, unlike Hillary Clinton's book. And I think he's figured out the Middle East, and he's also, I think, figured out, he's brought Dennis Ross, another has-been, back into the whole thing of talking to possibly Iran, certainly dealing with Southwest Asia. I think he realizes the limits and constraints and restraints upon any action he wants to take, if he ever does, about the Middle East. I was very struck, you know, when he was made, he used to be called Man of the Year, now it's Person of the Year, isn't it, in Time magazine. You know, he had page after page of an interview, and I was reading it on an Air France plane. I'm glad I was on an airplane, or I might have jumped off my balcony when I read it. And there were page after page of stuff about how he was going to make a new America, blah, 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 and quite a lot about Afghanistan. And just one single sentence about the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Only one sentence. And remember, this is a guy who didn't say a word during, except to say how unhappy he was about the casualties, during the attack on Gaza. I mean, a man who outspokenly and rightly condemned the atrocities in Mumbai was silent at the time of Gaza. And in the Time magazine article, and I have Time American edition in front of me, he says, he's talking about the priorities of his future administration. He wasn't yet the president. And here's the quote, and I beg you not to laugh. "And seeing if we can build on some of the progress, at least in conversation, that's been made around the Israeli-Palestinian conflict will be a priority." Now, you know, forgiving the grammar of this thing, what progress does he think has been built? And what does he mean by at least in conversation? And what progress has been made around, not with, but around the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? I mean, this is the language of a guy who's on the run. And I think he is, and he must be, you know, appalled that Netanyahu may well be the next prime minister, because Netanyahu makes it perfectly clear he doesn't want a Palestinian state. He wants security for Israel and throw a lot of money at the Palestinians so they'll be quiet. And he must be praying that somehow Livni gets into government, because after all, if Lieberman arrives, Avigdor Lieberman comes into the government and continues to talk about loyalty signatures from a minority community in Israel, the Arabs. Is he going to congratulate Netanyahu on the forming of a new government? Is a member of America's black community going to congratulate the prime minister of a country who includes in his government, who may include, we don't know, a man who demands loyalty signatures from a minority in his country? I cannot believe this. But, you know, I was in Kandahar just before Christmas in Afghanistan. I wasn't embedded. I was all over the city. I didn't see a single NATO soldier, not an American, not a Brit, not a Canadian. We're supposed to hold Kandahar. We're supposed to control it. Didn't see any. Saw plenty of Taliban supporters. In fact, some of them were wounded in hospital. I went to the Marwais Hospital in Kandahar, and there were, you know, one Taliban was dying with a bullet wound in his abdomen, presumably fired by a NATO soldier. There were two little girls who'd been... Their faces have been horribly burned with acid by Taliban supporters who didn't want them to go to school. But what was really shocking was that all day parents would come from villages in the province and from Helmand, bringing in these skeleton-like children, stick figure, you know, and saying, help, help, what's wrong with my child? And I was speaking with an Afghan doctor, and he said, they're starving, they have no food. They're not giving them bread. They had so few incubators in the hospital, they were putting three babies, starving babies, in one incubator to try to keep them alive and then to try and drip feed them. Now, I didn't know there was a famine in southern Afghanistan. I thought everyone was going around, well, I didn't think, but I mean, I was told everyone was going around building bridges and new roads and setting up prenatal clinics and then sending in soldiers to biff all the terrorists who didn't want this. Who said there was, I mean, why didn't we hear about people starving in this place? You know, I ended, at the time I was there, Obama was talking of sending 7,000 more troops, not 30,000. And I ended my story saying, we don't need 7,000 more Americans here. We need 7,000 American doctors here, you know? And it's like it's kind of skipped him by. Robert Gates is back playing the same old role he did under Bush. Dennis Ross, the has-been of all the so-called peace processes that were going to be put on back on track and never did. Hillary Clinton, a lady who's certainly not going to stand up to the Israelis in any form, because if she does, she won't become the next president of the United States, which is what her ambition is. I think there are pretty few prospects of any real change in the Middle East. Now, of course, the only difference would be if Netanyahu pushed Obama too far. You know, Obama can be a very short-tempered man, but so can Netanyahu. He can also be very arrogant. He's a very shrewd guy. He speaks with a beautiful, as we know, Brooklyn accent. But if those two came to blows, I don't mean it literally, I mean it metaphorically, I think it could be quite embarrassing all round in the United States as well for Netanyahu. Frankly predicting anything like that. I think that, you know, all the lefties, as I always call them, and the pinkos, they all hope that, you know, Obama's suddenly going to step forward and become, you know, Lincoln come Eisenhower in one go. It's not going to happen.
Say a little bit more about the history of Netanyahu. Yeah, I know that neighborhood. My family's from the same neighborhood in Brooklyn. I know it well. But say a little bit more about his policies. And you were talking about the loyalty oath, some of the coalitions that might come together. Tell people who we're talking about.
The question you have to think about Netanyahu is, he doesn't tell the truth. Now, whether this is a pathological thing, like, you know, he never did, so therefore he thinks he can get away with it, I don't know. I know that Clinton was outraged constantly by what he thought were Netanyahu's lies to him. Netanyahu would promise one thing and do the other. I remember specifically a press conference that Netanyahu held with Mubarak in Cairo. You know, poor old Mubarak, Lavash Kiri, as we called him in Egypt, sort of smiling, you know, rather in a rather wan way at Netanyahu. Netanyahu was going on about how, you know, certain Palestinian homes in East Jerusalem had to be demolished because they weren't built with, you know, proper permits. So I put my hand up and went up and said, Mr. Prime Minister, can you tell us how many permits Palestinians can have for building homes in West Jerusalem? And he said, there's nothing stopping them doing that. They're perfectly permitted to do it if they wish. And Mubarak's head switched round like a shot. I mean, this is complete rubbish. They can't do anything of the kind. And Netanyahu, but he tried to get away with it. He just said it on the hope, I suppose, it would go out on the TV thing and no one would challenge him. And I said, just a minute. He said, no, they can do it. Palestinians, of course they can. If they're living in Jerusalem, they can buy property in West Jerusalem. Why not? This was news to the Israelis, of course. And, you know, the Egyptian press, which is an awful gutter journalism anyway, the next day was saying, you know, even the president was taken aback by this obvious total untruth. So you've got a guy who, you know, dresses very beautifully and has a perfect American accent, and very slick guy on TV, charges a lot of money for lectures. I was told several years ago he was charging $100,000 to give a lecture in Canada. Well, that's because I don't charge for lectures, probably, but I just say that. But, I mean, I'm told that's correct. But a man who clearly cannot be relied upon to say things which are actually true, and this is a problem. Now, when he says, I want security for Israel, I'm not interested in a Palestinian state, that's probably true. Well, he's never got security for Israel. I mean, you know, Israelis deserve security. They won't get it through Netanyahu. But I think he's basically against the whole idea of the, quote, peace process, unquote. And then you have George Mitchell, you know, who's the Middle East envoy. Now, I know Mitchell goes laden with honors from Northern Ireland, where he played a prominent role in the whole system of what was rather laughingly called decommissioning of IRA weapons, and then the Good Friday Agreement. And Mitchell's a nice guy. I've met him actually in Belfast just over a year ago. But Mitchell's 75 years old. He doesn't like the continued building of settlements, but he can't deal with the Israelis. He's not up to standing up to Netanyahu and starting talking about the immorality of committing illegal acts, which, and they are, it is internationally illegal to build homes for Jews and Jews only on Arab land. And then we have the wall, which is still laughingly called the fence or the security barrier in your newspapers, and so on and so forth. And given the economic catastrophe which allegedly hovers over you guys over there, I don't think Obama is going to be able to deal with the Middle East.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are speaking with Robert Fisk. He is the correspondent for the Independent of London, based in Beirut, has reported extensively for decades from the Middle East. I was looking, Robert, at you know, the review for your book, Pity the Nation, in which you deal extensively with what happened in Lebanon, and you have investigated extensively the massacres at Sabra and Shatila. And we haven't spoken since the sort of three-week savage bombing of Gaza, and I want to get your take on that, and perhaps what was going through your mind. Did you see sort of memories of?
I had memories of the Kana massacre of 1996, when you remember Israeli artillery fired proximity shells into a UN camp full of refugees and killed 106 civilians, more than half of them children. Actually, when the Gaza thing began, I decided that if you can't go into Gaza, there's no point in going there. I mean, I cover wars if I can be in them. I'm not going to sit on a hill of shame 2 miles away wearing some stupid blue flak jacket and pontificating into the camera with the usual 50% balance to all sides, right or wrong. I was actually in Canada when this began, and what I tried to explore was what was the stories that were not being told. And one of the first ones which I pointed out was, the Palestinians of Gaza, almost 50% of them, are the survivors, or the children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren, of the Nakba, the catastrophe which overwhelmed the Palestinians in 48 with the creation of the State of Palestine. They were either driven out or fled from their homes. And most of these Palestinians fled their property, which they legally owned, just north of the Gaza Strip. And I pointed out, or rather I asked the question, why my colleagues, or why nobody on the, you know, TV shows, had pointed out that Hamas were firing rockets at territory, which in many cases, under international law, legally belongs to the families of those who are firing the rockets. Now, this didn't, you know, this was just simply not picked up. I mean, this is an extraordinary historical irony. In any other context, any other historical reporting in the world, anywhere, South Africa, Russia, China, Yugoslavia, we'd have had that up there at the top of the story. What was the zilch? And then I found another very interesting phenomenon that was happening as I traveled around Canada. And that was a sort of a systematic propaganda that was really quite remarkable because of the way in which it was obviously planned, you know, a long time in advance. I'll give an example of this. For example, in Vancouver, I came across a writer who put in one of the Vancouver papers, Can you imagine what it's like to be shelled in your home? And maybe you have a home in South Vancouver, and militants living in Richmond were lobbing rockets every day across the Fraser River, right? And then I move on. Then I get as far as Toronto, and Lorne Gunter in the Toronto Globe and Mail is saying, suppose you lived in the Toronto suburb of Don Mills, which is quite a middle-class area to the east of Toronto City, and people from the suburb of Scarborough, 10 kilometers away, were firing as many as 100 rockets a day into your yard, your kid's school, the strip mall down the street. And then I arrive in Montreal, and I find the following. Perhaps you lived in Montreal's Outremont neighborhood, and your children had weekly emergency drills because people who hated you, absolutely blindly hated you, and everyone from your community were launching missiles by the score into your cul-de-sac and the nearby playground, and they'd been doing it for 7 years. The Montreal newspaper La Presse had a similar thing. Imagine for a moment that children in Longueuil, that's a suburb of Montreal, live every day and night in terror that businesses, shops, hospitals, schools are going to be the target of terrorists located at Brossard. Brossard is actually the location of the University of Sherbrooke, many of whose students, of course, are Muslim. Then I mercifully crossed the Atlantic to Paris en route to Dublin. And then en route I opened my National Post, published in Toronto, to find Robert Fulford saying, is France prepared to hold its fire if Belgium starts lobbing explosives across its border? Then mercifully, I arrive in Dublin, where I'm now speaking to you from, but I open the Irish Times to find a letter from Zion Evroni, the Israeli ambassador to Ireland, saying, the questions I've been asking the Irish people are fundamental to any discussion of Israel's action. What would you do if Dublin was subjected to a bombardment of 8,000 rockets and mortars similar to that endured by Israeli towns and cities for 8 years? It was 7 years just now, but anyway, obviously the flight across the Atlantic took a year. I mean, can you see, I tried to explain this in Montreal to an audience. I was speaking in French. I called it infantilisme. The best translation is babyishness. This is the way in which we, the Westerners, the insulting way that we were supposed to support a bombardment in which 13 Israeli citizens were killed, four of them soldiers killed by their own people, and two of them, by the way, Arab Israelis, though that wasn't pointed out at the time, and yet more than 1,300 Palestinians, four of them children, were killed. And then suddenly we're told, oh, no, we mustn't get into this business. It's asymmetrical warfare. That was the next game. It was asymmetrical warfare. I mean, there was a letter popped up in the National Post. I'm just looking at it here now. Again, Toronto. Israel and the rest of the world have the right and the obligation to obliterate every single terrorist in the world. Fairly ambitious undertaking. In Gaza, Lebanon, Iraq, Afghanistan, every country in the West who at this very moment are funding global terror activity, and so on and so forth. And, you know, just towards the end of the war, I was in Beirut. I'd got back to Beirut. Mercifully, the Israelis didn't ask the people of Beirut to think what it was like to be shelled over and over again, because they have been by the Israelis. You know, I was on a BBC World Service live, thank goodness, program at night with an editor of the Jerusalem Post. And the moment I pointed out the obvious thing that is a bit odd, you know, 13 versus 1,300, that's an exchange rate of one dead Israeli for 100 Palestinians. That's an even bigger exchange rate than we had in the Lebanon War of 2006 between Muslims and Israelis. He said, you know, it's not about numbers. You can't see there's being anything about numbers at all. And I said, you know, if it was more than 1,300 Israelis dead, and thank God it is not, and only 13 Palestinians dead, you would not be making that argument on the BBC tonight. And there was a three-second silence while he sort of reflected upon this. And then he said, we're all sorry at the death of any human being. And I just said, well, you know, that's good to hear. It's very good to hear. But really, Dennis, I mean, the amount of hypocrisy involved, and in the reporting of this, was absolutely stunning. I've never seen anything like it. The fact that not a single Western reporter actually got in to Gaza, I mean, in most places where we're forbidden, I mean, even at Hama in 1982, the Syrian massacre of Muslim militants in Hama, I got into Hama for 18 minutes. At least I saw what was bloody well going on there. You know, and not one of these flat-jacketed journalists outside. I mean, I'm not really blaming my colleagues. I couldn't probably get in either. But it was very, what was particularly important, I think, was the way in which Palestinian journalists, because the Western correspondents couldn't come in with their usual, quote, balanced, unquote, journalism, Palestinian journalists found that they were able to tell their own story in their own words. And I thought that was really quite remarkable. It was done in an extraordinary way. They did it very fairly. And for the first time, we had Palestinians actually telling their own story. I don't know if you're aware that our Palestinian correspondent in Gaza, his father was killed by the Israelis during the war. And there was a very powerful front page story we carried.
What was his name? Robert?
Fariz Akram. The story was headlined on the front page, The Death and Life of My Father. And I'll just read you a couple of paragraphs so you see the power of it.
Please.
The phone call came at around 4:20 p.m. on Saturday. A bomb had been dropped on the house at our small farm in northern Gaza. My father was walking from the gate to the farmhouse at the time. It was our beloved place, that farm in its two-story white house with a red roof. Nestled in a flat, fertile agricultural plain northwest of Beit Lahia, it had lemon groves, orange and apricot trees, and we had recently acquired 60 dairy cows. This man, by the way, was a fluent English speaker, a judge, a pro-Fatah, pro-Palestinian authority person, didn't like Hamas at all. And he goes on, shortly before sunset on Saturday, as Israeli ground troops and tanks invaded Gaza in the name of shutting down Hamas rocket sites, the peace of that place was shattered and my father's life extinguished at the age of 48. Warplanes and helicopters had swept in, bombing and firing to open up the space for the tanks and the ground forces that would follow in the darkness. It was one of those F-16 airstrikes that killed my father. The house was reduced to little more than powder, and of Dad, there was nothing much left either, just a pile of flesh, my uncle, who found him in the rubble, said later with brutal honesty. And he finishes, my grief carries no desire for revenge, which I know to be always in vain, but in truth as a grieving son, I'm finding it hard to distinguish between what the Israelis call terrorists and the Israeli pilots and tank crews who are invading Gaza. What is the difference between the pilot who blew my father to pieces and the militant who fires a small rocket? I have no answers. My wife is pregnant, and just as I am to become a father, I have lost my father. Well, I don't think you'd have found anything as powerful as that from any Western reporter. So maybe, to use the old cliche, there was a flip side to the censorship of the Western press by the Israelis.
Well, I am really glad that you brought this up, Robert, and want to talk a little bit more about it. What we decided to do on Flashpoints was preempt all other programming and give our hour every night to what was going on the ground. And the way we managed to do that is to work with some of the Palestinian reporters like Sama Habib and Fidakista, who ended up hooking up with The Guardian and doing some very important reporting.
And remember that Al Jazeera International distinguished itself for the first time by English language reporting from both sides. They did it. And we weren't there. I mean, what was very interesting, there wasn't a single Western newspaper office in Gaza.
It was extraordinary. And then the way we worked, and I'm interested to know your response to this, the other part of what we did from north to south, the entire strip, is we, if we couldn't find the Palestinians on the ground or the educators, Palestinian educators, we hooked up with all these human rights workers, whether they were with the International Solidarity Movement, but they were riding or trying to ride ambulances, and we're thinking that's the best way to get at least a first shot, a contemporaneous shot while it's happening, because you and I know that what the Israelis like to do is keep everybody out, and as soon as you make a mistake, they say, you see, you don't know what the hell you're talking
about.
Well,
that's what they did at Jenin, if you remember, where, first of all, an Israeli radio said there'd been a massacre. Then other journalists said there was a massacre. Then they wouldn't let journalists in to check, and afterwards they said, look, you're a lie, there is no massacre. I never said there was, though I should have done, because when my colleagues investigated, there clearly had been. But it's becoming, you see, a kind of normality now. I'm writing about this in my next book, the way in which, you know, you embed journalists, they accept it. You have the 2019, the war for the liberation of Kuwait in 1991, and thousands, tens of thousands of Iraqis were smothered in sand by U.S. forces driving, you know, bulldozers, but no journalists were there, and it simply didn't get covered. And we're now actually falling into the habit, it's become a normality for journalists not to report from the scene, and then to be accused later of lying if they tried to find out what was happening at the scene, which they couldn't because they weren't there. But I think the Palestinians, I mean, I think that in years to come, we will look back and say that this was a watershed, again, a cliche I hate, in the reporting of the Middle East, that we don't need these Western reporters in their flak jackets with their huge salaries and their business class air travel. we can do with the Palestinians. They're on the ground, and they did a very good job.
All right. And finally, coming back, focusing on Iraq and also, you know, taking a look as in a parallel structure, Afghanistan, Obama is talking about leaving 50,000 troops, a couple of dozen bases. Is this a flip-flop?
It's not a flip-flop. It's just that you see the reporters who were covering the election were saying, you know, all troops out by X. You needed to read between the lines, or actually all you had to do was read the agreements between the U.S. forces and the U.S. administration and the Iraqi government, I put government in quotation marks, to realize that a substantial force, 60,000, the total of all American troops currently in Afghanistan, would remain behind to, quote, train, unquote, Iraqi forces. In other words, they're not going to leave. A lot are going to leave, but a lot are going to stay. Do you really think the Iraqis are so stupid as not to realize that? They know. It is we who are fooling ourselves. You know, just like after the disclosures of the torture and abuse in Abu Ghraib, the Pentagon running around like a chicken saying, don't publish these pictures, the Iraqis will hate us. And I was in Baghdad. I remember writing in my paper, you know, they already hate you. They know it's going on. It is we Westerners who didn't realize what was happening in Abu Ghraib. It is we Westerners who were shocked at the abuse and the torture, just as it is we Westerners now who are surprised, oh, 50, 60,000 troops of the United States still in Iraq after the withdrawal by Obama. The Iraqis spotted this a long time ago. The Arab press have been pointing it out for weeks.
So where does this policy lead now? Same, more, deeper, dying continues. What happens in Iraq? What's your sort of...
I think the insurgents are going to make such an inroad eventually. I mean, it's died down for the moment because we're paying the insurgents huge amounts of money not to attack us. But are we going to continue doing that, or will they start attacking each other as they did in the past? I don't think the Iraq story is over. I think there's a much darker side still to come. And as for Afghanistan, I mean, you know, the fact that when I got there, I never saw a Westerner who didn't have armed guards, except for me. But I didn't see a Westerner who didn't have armed guards around him. And I must make an exception, actually. I did see delegates of the International Red Cross in Kandahar, the only non-governmental organization brave enough to stay. And they had no weapons and no protection. And they existed there with contacts with the Taliban and contacts with NATO and contacts with everyone saying, we are here for humanitarian purposes. And they're still there. God bless them, I would say, if I believed that much in God.
And just to grab this issue, back to Israel, we know the U.S. Rushed weaponry, as they did in the attacks in Lebanon, to the Israelis, advanced weaponry, unconventional weaponry. What are the chances that everybody's saying this was so savage and so obvious that there has to be a war crimes investigation? What say you?
Look, I believe in planet Earth, not in Father Christmas and fairies at the bottom of my garden. Bush, and I've just got a heap of mail that's just arriving me here in Dublin from readers saying, we can really get Blair on war crimes charges. Forget it. The world doesn't work that way. What surprises me, having investigated this at great length, is why individual families who've been torn to pieces, literally, and killed in some cases, by U.S. missiles don't sue Boeing and Lockheed Martin and all these immensely wealthy missile manufacturers all over the United States who are producing these filthy things and then either selling them or allowing the United States to give them to the Israelis who then use them on civilians. There must be some form of responsibility here. And I'm surprised. You know, I mean, forget the Arab governments because they'll say, you know, they wouldn't say boo to a goose. But I'm surprised there hasn't been one or two specific examples of individual Arabs who have been terribly wounded, literally, by these missiles and weapons, who haven't either gone to New York or got lawyers to get good advocates in New York, serious lawyers, you know, really powerful lawyers in New York, to go for these major companies and demand massive remuneration for their wounds because they made these vile instruments which have torn to pieces so many people in the Arab world.
All right, Robert Fisk, author of The Great War for Civilization, The Conquest of the Middle East, an incredible history, contemporary history of the Middle East. He is the correspondent for The Independent of London. He's based in Beirut, talking to us now from Ireland. And Robert, thanks for giving us a half hour of very good information.
You're welcome, Dennis.
The day the world gets round, to understanding where it is. Using all it's found to help each other hand in hand. The day the world gets round to understanding where it's gone. Losing so much ground, killing each other hand in hand. Such foolishness in man, I want no part of their plan.
My name is Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints. Howard Zinn literally changed history and the way it's understood as it relates to the United States of America, that's for sure. A People's History of the United States is indeed a classic and expansive correction column that shows the real history of the U.S. and the people who made it. Several years ago, people came together to found Voices of a People's History that attempts, through performance, to bring the actual tone and feeling of the history and the voices of the people who made history. History as represented in this marvelous book. This weekend at Mission High School Auditorium here in San Francisco in the Bay Area, Howard Zinn himself will join Voices for a reading. Joining Professor Zinn in the local presentation will be Benjamin Bratt, Josh Brolin, Diane Lane, Boots Riley of The Coup, Renee Salcedo, our special Friday co-host here on Flashpoint, Stairwell Sisters Clarence Thomas, Carrie Washington, and Robin Wright Penn, and joining us to talk about this wonderful and important event and his work is Professor Howard Zinn. Welcome back, Professor Zinn. It's good to have you with us.
Oh, well, thank you.
Pleasure. And, well, let me ask this sort of very basic question, maybe the short answer, but for people who are meeting you for the first time in these airwaves and in San Francisco, why did you write People's History of the United States?
Well, I wrote A People's History of the United States because an awful lot of histories had been written about the United States and the people were missing from it. By that I mean that the history, as I learned it in school, you know, and after I majored in history and got my doctorate in history, so I had a good sampling of what kind of history is taught in the university, and I remembered what I had been taught in high school, and it was all history, really, from the viewpoint of the top, of the people in authority. It was about, you know, presidential pronouncements, and in fact, you know, think of how many histories I'd done through presidents, the age of Lincoln, the age of Roosevelt, the, you know, the founding fathers, the and you know, the pages of history are full of military victories and important people. I wanted to bring back I shouldn't say bring back because they hadn't been there, but I wanted to bring into the pages of history the voices of ordinary people, the voices of well, certainly of Native Americans, of working people, of black people, of immigrants, and anti-war protesters, dissenters, socialists, anarchists, troublemakers. I was tired of seeing history taught from the point of view of people at the top, because that the point of view of people at the top is very, very different, and their interests are not you know, the interests of most of the people.
Well, now, you mentioned immigrants, and obviously, even now as we speak, there is a major struggle for immigrant rights. 12 million people who do the hardest work in this country are being brutalized. They're off the radar screen. How would these people now, this immigrant population, how should they be represented in your people's history?
Well, what we try to do, of course, and you know, what I try to do in my book is bring out the feelings of these people, the voices of these people, the point of view of these people. You know, for instance, to take note of the fact that in the Mexican War of 1846-48, the United States took half of Mexico, including all this beautiful territory in the southwest, and now the United States government is trying to keep these people in Mexico from crossing an artificial border. That's artificial in the sense it was created by American military victory, crossing his border into the territory that Mexico formerly owned. I mean, it's an irony, but when you give the history of working people in this country as we do, you inevitably tell a story of immigrants. When in my book, in the People's History, when I tell the story of the Lawrence Textile Strike of 1912, well, the people who participated in that strike were mostly immigrant women. When I tell a story of the Colorado coal strike, the Ludlow Massacre of 1913-14, it's a story of immigrants, of Mexicans, of workers from southeastern Europe. It's the story of people who came to this country and who are working very, very hard for very, very low wages and are being exploited and who rebel against their condition. Try to represent these people who are unrepresented.
Now, speaking of presidents and in the context of the people's history, it's a little troubling to see the new president sort of picking a war and doing what Democrats seem to do best when they get into power, which is to sort of try and bomb or start a war to show that they're tougher than the Republicans. You see a little history repeating itself here?
Well, yes. yes, certainly the history of presidential wars repeats itself, and Obama seems to be so far no different than the others. It's very disturbing to see that. One of the first things that happens when Obama becomes president, he sends Predator missiles over Pakistan, and what's the result? Of course, people die in Pakistan as a result of these missiles. It's the most stupid thing you can do in terms of trying to counter terrorism, because what you're doing is you're creating more terrorists. You're creating anger against the United States with good reason, because you send missiles over Pakistan. You're attacking a country with which we're not at war. Obama comes into office saying he's going to abide by the rule of law. He's violating international law immediately by bombing Pakistan and killing people. Clinton did the same thing when he first came into office. And you're right, it seems to be the predisposition of presidents to show that they're tough. And of course, so this is what I mean by telling history from the point of view of the top. We have to tell history from the point of view of the people who are the victims of presidential pronouncements, the people who are protesting against presidential policies. And the Obama victory, which in a certain sense was heartening because, yes, for the first time an African American had been elected, but in another sense shouldn't blind us to the fact that Obama is still another president, still another politician, that if he does not represent the interests of the people of the United States. He doesn't even represent the interests of the black people of the United States. Because he represents, unfortunately, the interests of the leaders of the Democratic Party, the corporate interests in this country. He's shown that so far by the people he's appointed in the economic sector. He's shown it so far, you know, by his economic policies, which, yes, you can say they're better than Bush's. Everything is better than Bush's. But the fact is that Obama's economic policies are not going to solve the problem for poor people or even for the middle class in this country.
We're speaking to Howard Zinn. He is going to be in San Francisco on February 26th, coming on up this weekend, 7 p.m., Mission High School, the Voices of the People's History of the United States, in which some of these marvelous voices from history, sometimes people on the crowd scenes of history, sometimes people's names who you don't know but whose fingerprints are on everything you touch, are represented in these beautiful writings by Howard Zinn, and they'll be performed, brought to life. And we're going to let you go, Professor Zinn, but how about this for just the final question? What about, do you think maybe, I'm thinking maybe the most important people's history we may need right now is, say, the people's history of Palestine and Israel? We haven't seen that one yet, have we?
Well, you know, if we were really telling them people's history, we'd talk about American foreign policy in terms of the victims of American foreign policy. The Palestinian people are, at the present time, they're the direct victims of Israeli aggression, but they're the indirect victims of American foreign policy, which has supported Israel in all of its rather brutal activities of occupying Palestinian territory, invading Lebanon, invading Gaza, bombing people, doing basically in the Palestinian lands what the United States has been doing in other parts of the world. And so, we would really doing American foreign policy from a people's point of view, we would be telling the story of the victims of American foreign policy.
All right, Howard Zinn, we're going to hear a little bit more about the evening from your partner, Anthony Arnov, but we're going to let you go and thank you very much for all the extraordinary work and all these very crucial corrections of history. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
I'm Dennis Bernstein. It's time every Wednesday. We have community business with Catherine Austin Fitz, and there's a lot of business going on in the community and a lot of business going on that will impact in a very devastating way all of us. Decisions being made now. U.S. President Barack Obama stays in the spotlight. He's talking about laying down some clear rules for the troubled financial industry. He's saying we need to protect consumers and investors. He said, I guess yesterday, we can no longer sustain 21st century markets with 20th century regulations. I'm not sure exactly what the hell he's talking about, Catherine Austin Fitz, but maybe you give me your take.
You know something, Dennis? I really don't know what he's talking about, because if you look at what he's doing, he's talking about more centralized control, which is the problem that got us into this in the first place. So we're essentially creating a process where we get more of what caused the problem in the first place. In other words, we're not asking the question, who did this, and how do we replace them and find structures that are more resilient, particularly at a local level. Instead, we're consolidating and centralizing things even more. So what he's saying is kind of, it's an Orwellian, spin to the failure to engage in real discussion about what's really going on and basically promoting a system where crime pays, same old, same old.
Now, he also did make it clear that there's another $700 billion for the bank's rescue fund so that they will then lend out some of this money, I guess.
Well, it doesn't really matter because, in fact, Americans don't need more debt. The hole that we're in came about as a result of taking on more debt than we could afford. So the idea that we'll give more money to the banks so that they can loan us money is just the road to serfdom. We don't need more debt. We need our equity to not be drained. So, for example, we're seeing revived again proposals to change the 401k system to be something that the government would manage, at the same time that we have William Greeter writing an article in The Nation basically warning us that Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid is going to be re-engineered on the theory that we can't afford it. You put those two things together, and basically, after looting the federal credit, we're saying we now can't afford the social safety net. So what we're going to do is integrate the 401ks to prop it up. So, if you really do the algebra on the combination of these different things, what we've got is we've not yet had a discussion at the national level about what's really going on and how we can make the economy stronger. We don't have an economic or financial problem. We have an evil problem. And staring at evil and looking at evil is a... it's a scary and unpleasant thing, but it's better than letting evil have its way.
All right. Well, let's just talk a little bit about where this may be going for homeowners. Do you think they're... Well, first of all, let me tell people they're listening to Catherine Austin Fitz. This is Wednesday. It's community business. And if she sounds a little bit distant because we got her to pull over in her car, let's just say that she's somewhere along the road in Tennessee. Is that right?
Right. I'm always stopping at truck stops for you. This time I'm by the side of the road.
All right. Now, back to the business. So you say the government can't rescue the loss in terms of the 401k. So that's not what happens when they give the money to the banks. It's not going to be recycled in the 401k with the government ownership in the banks.
Well, are we talking about the bailout now or the proposals on the 401k?
Well, let's start with the bailout.
Well, the The latest report, we had inspector generals reporting in congressional testimony recently that less than 5% of the banks have reported what they've done with the bailout money. So the reality is we don't know what's happened to the bailout money because we have no, it's being invested in institutions, and then those institutions are putting it into their general funds, and it's part of the capital that they use in their business. So we really don't know where it's going. The reality, though, is even if you wanted to have banks lend more, banks can't lend according to regulation or good business practice. They can't lend to something if there's not a healthy chance of getting paid back. And right now, the problem in the economy is that the financial equity is disappearing and the income is dropping. And so, in fact, there's fewer and fewer things that they can loan to that make sense from a financial standpoint. Because what we're doing is we're giving equity to the banks, but there's, we're not investing equity in the parts of the economy that can create more income and jobs. I think we mentioned this last week, there's a wonderful research roundup from the Kauffman Foundation, which has wonderful research and a wonderful research director, Bob Lytan. And their research shows that 100% of the net job growth in America from 1980 onwards to 2005 comes from companies that have been started less than 5 years before. So it's basically startups and small business that are generating the jobs, that and the military. So we're investing in banks and a lot of big banks, and that equity is going up down a black hole, and it's not being invested in the parts of the economy that create real economic muscle.
All right, let's come to the savings part of this. So you say on your blog, I guess yesterday or today, that the George Orwell Award should go to Dean Baker, who thinks the solution is to give the government more power over our retirement savings. After all, you write, an organization that is refused to produce financial statements for more than a decade comply with the laws regarding financial management and is missing. No. Okay, so what's the problem here? Why does he win?
Well, the most Americans have suffered tremendous losses in the 401k, and the spin is now, and we're seeing this from Dean Baker, that retirement savings should not be used to take market risk. So retirement savings should not be exposed to economic risk, and the solution to the problem is to instead have the money managed by government with a steady guaranteed income. Now, in fact, this goes back to trying to solve a problem before you know what the problem is. What we saw was tremendous losses in the 401k happen because of tremendous criminality and mismanagement of the economy from the top. And the solution is not to then turn over people's private savings for control by the government. In other words, we don't need more centralized control. That's what got us in this mess. We need decentralization, and individuals need control of their retirement savings and control of their assets. The notion that people are incompetent to manage their own money is insane. And if we really believe that, then maybe we should provide financial literacy and education in the schools, which we don't. And that's not an accident.
All right, we're just running out of time here. We have a couple of minutes. Let's talk about, in that context, on the positive side, what you mean and what you're talking about and thinking about when you talk about transition economies and transition communities.
Sure. Transition Towns was a movement that's come out of Ireland, and it's really captured the imagination of people all over the world. I'm emailing regularly with people in New Zealand, people in California, people in the UK, all doing transition towns. And transition towns, really, Dennis, is a process methodology. It started with one town in Ireland getting together and saying, we need to make other plans. We need to really build local resiliency and self-sufficiency here, and they came up with what was called a dissent plan. And out of that came the idea of creating a process methodology for towns to organize together and start to make provision to build much greater self-sufficiency. And when there's a group of us who did a financial permaculture conference in Hohenwald, Tennessee last October and brought together members of the permaculture community and members of the finance community and went to work with the leadership in the Chamber of Commerce, and it's really a committee called the Sonnenschein Committee in Hohenwald. And what came out of that was Andy Langford, who's a wonderful permaculturalist from the UK, gave a presentation with Albert Bates from the farm on transition towns. And it just, you know, it just resonated. It was fantastic. And now Hohenwald is going through the process. There's a whole process you need to go through to launch, and they hope to launch their transition town status this September at the second Financial Permaculture Summit. And it's really a way, because from, I think most people find it overwhelming to kind of grapple with, well, how do I get to know my neighbors and organize my community? And transition towns really gives you a process and a methodology to do it that is, you know, is happening all over the country. And now one of the sort of inventors of this has published a manual, the transition manual that, or the transition handbook, I think it is, that really walks you through the steps. And so I would really encourage anybody listening to check out the Transition Town Wiki, which different towns that have passed into transition town status are listed there. But what you'll also find is there are groups forming to discuss transition towns and, you know, becoming a transition town all over the country. So it's something you can really plug into wherever you are.
All right. Well, I need to jump in, but Catherine, how about just so that manual is a way of people finding more out about it. I know you're not talking about survivalists and the posse comitatus in the country side,
but I think you are talking about
manifesting local resources and keeping an eye and a hand on it. We're out of time, but how about I suggest people check you out at solari.com/blog and watch what you're doing on this permaculture and this other stuff, and look forward to talking to you next week.
Great, Dennis.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight. Our interim technical director is Eric Klein, and our production assistants are Emily Howard and Evelina Molina. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Amanda Bellerby is our environmental producer and also produces the weekly Best of Flashpoints. To comment on today's program or to subscribe to our Fight Back email list, please contact us at flashpoints@kpfa.org. You can look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archived shows. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening. Music this week, The Day the World Gets Round by Yosef Islam, and I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free by Nina Simone. I'm Amanda Bellerby for Flashpoints.